Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm Linda P. Jones from Be Wealthy and Smart. Before we get started today, we have a word from our sponsor. Take it away, Miranda.
Hey, we're so excited to do the listener questions today, but before we get there, we do need to ask you a question. Have you ever wondered if there was a way to capitalize on all of the online chatter of the millions of investors on social media? Your wait is over because the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds are now at your fingertips. Make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index, licensed to an exchange-traded fund and trading under ticker symbol BUZ, provides investors with a portfolio of securities that delivers a basket of large cap U.S. equities, which show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment. No surveys, no guessing. Buzz only tracks what's volunteered, and if you are online, you know that a lot of information is volunteered. Millions of posts, comments, and blogs are analyzed every month. Here's how it works. First, Buzz targets the most mentioned large U.S. cap stocks across the social media landscape. The more active the conversation, the greater the reliability of the buzz. Each of the most mentioned stocks is then given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics, and the 75 stocks with the most bullish scores are included in the index. Each month, the Buzz is tracked to capture the latest big data-driven insights, and then the 75 companies with the most bullish scores are selected, positioning Buzz to capture the highest return potential. Invest in the wisdom of the crowds. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information.
All right, we're driving in the Lamborghini today, and we have someone standing in for Joe Salcihi, our dear friend Shannon McClay from the podcast Martinis and Your Money and the founder of Financial Gym. How are you, Shannon?
I'm fantastic. So glad to be back with you guys.
Very cool to have you here. What's been going on with you?
Well, we are just getting people financially fit here at the Financial Gym in New York City. We work with people one-on-one to give them financial planning, and then also drinking on my podcast, Martinis and Your Money. Nothing better than drinking and talking about money.
Well, I was just on a cruise. We had a lot of martinis we tried, so at the martini bar. So that was pretty fun. I thought of you.
That is fun. I think everything's more fun in a martini glass. Like every beverage, if you just put any beverage in a martini glass, it's like instant fun. Fun in a glass.
Yeah, it's amazing. And Doug Goldstein, all the way from Israel, from Goldstein on Gelt and Rich as a King. How are you, my friend?
Well, I'm overwhelmed. I have to tell you, Linda, if I can just spill a little bit. I'm dealing with estate issues for my father, and I got a letter from Social Security. It said, you will soon receive, whatever, a couple of $1,000s or something. And this letter was like a month ago, and obviously we didn't receive it, and I don't know what to do. So if anyone out there works for Social Security and can help me out, please, please, I would be very grateful.
All right. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I know you also have a wedding on the horizon and some other major things coming up.
Yeah. Like in just moments, we're going to sign with the wedding hall. So that's exciting.
It is exciting. But, you know, those are all stressful events in life, right? They're up on the stress meter, whether they're good or not.
I'm guessing
good.
Social Security is like a 2000 and your kid getting married is like an 8. So we'll see. Ask me at the end of the summer. I'll tell you how the wedding went.
All right. We want to hear all about it. And so do our listeners.
I hope so. Thank you.
Miranda, how are you at planting money seeds and adulting?
I'm doing well. We've got good weather here. And I'm excited to have Shannon on because I have been on Martinis and Your Money and have enjoyed the drinking and the talking finance. Yeah, and it was super fun.
And it was.
And the honest truth is that I can't podcast without drinking. So I'm really drinking right now with you guys.
Nice.
Just kidding.
I was just going to say, getting started before noon.
I don't judge, okay? Don't judge, Miranda.
And Miranda, it is after 5 in Israel, so it's not a problem.
Yeah, I'm with Doug.
There you go. It's after 5 in Israel.
There are many mornings where I get up and I'm just like, maybe I should just start the day with a drink.
Right? Maybe a quick shot's going to get this day going, make it better.
That's right.
I love how you all pause. Like, is she really drinking?
It would not surprise me, and it'd be okay. But we've got listener questions, so let's do this.
On that note, let's get over to our listener questions. All right. Our first question comes from Matthew. He says, "Hi, my name is Matthew. I'm from Sydney, Australia. Listening to your show acted as the catalyst for me to stop thinking and take action on my financial future. I first started out thinking that I'll outperform the market and get rich. However, after listening to your show, as well as doing my own research, I found out how unlikely this is, especially for myself, who is a novice with stocks. Instead, I have implemented a more conservative and realistic plan." Okay, let's hear it. "I have deposited $150,000 into three broad ETFs, the S&P 500, the All World ETF, and ASX 200, which is the Australian version of the S&P. My plan is to deposit $40,000 annually and reinvest all dividends for the next 20 years, expecting a 10 to 12% return. I'm also putting a small sum away each month in a high interest savings account for when the market does eventually crash. I plan to use this money when the market crashes 40%. And he says, "I forget why I chose this number. I also have 5% of my money in 2 to 3 individual satellite stocks for more fun than anything else. I should mention I'm 27 and have no debts. I plan to retire around the next 20 years, give or take 5 years. I like my strategy, which I must give you guys a lot of credit for. However, I was wondering, is there anything else I can do to boost my investment strategy? Or is this the best a passive investor can do? Cheers from down under, Matthew." Wow, well, let's start with Doug. Doug, what do you think of his investment plan?
I'm a little curious. It looks like of the $150,000, he's simply broken into three, mostly large cap indices. So my question back to you would be, do you feel this is enough diversification? Normally, I think it's a good idea to break up the money into multiple ETFs, or I personally like to do with money managers, but I get it. I think the do-it-yourself model is also fine, but I would encourage you to begin to look a little more broadly because there is more out there in the world. The S&P 500, as we've spoken about, is a capitalization-weighted index, so it's really just a few major, major companies which have the most influence on it. So that's one thing I would look at, and I'm very happy that you are so optimistic. You'll make 10 to 12% a year. I think that would be great. I wish you luck on that, but if your prophecy is not as strong as other people's, it may not turn out that way. So if you're expecting to retire at age 47, because I assume you've done the math, maybe it's not going to work out exactly that way. So you may want to have kind of a backup plan, like a career.
What do you think is a more realistic rate of return?
Yeah, I don't know about that. I'm not sure we're going to see the 10 to 12% that we've seen maybe over the past 50 to 70 years, which people like to quote. I would be cutting that down a little bit just to be more realistic. Mm-hmm. I can't give you a number, Linda. Sorry. Because yeah. Someone's going to call me in 40 years and say, remember that podcast that you were on?
Yeah. So yeah. Just real quick, whenever I'm estimating my long-term annualized returns, I actually just settle on, 6 or 7%. I know that it's probably going to do better than that. But when I'm just, making my own plans, deciding how much I want to invest each month or each year, I actually base it on a 6 to 7%. That way, I'm most likely investing more than I need to. And I'd rather be wrong because I was too conservative in my estimates than wrong because I was too excited about it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm with you, Miranda. I actually advise my clients I give them the 6 to 8% number as well. And I tell them that's the, estimate for that. And the same as you, I'd rather be over conservative, especially when you're planning something, especially for something like early retirement and retirement, because you're going to need that money to last you a long time. And I'd rather be on the conservative side, as far as getting there. So I give 6 to 8, and I said, everybody wants to be surprised on the positive side, but I think it's just hard to do that over time with so much information available in the stock market. I think it's just really hard to get that much of a difference over time.
I completely agree. I like to use around an 8% number. A few things I noticed is that, like Doug, I think he needs more broader diversification. I think that, right now the small caps have been outperforming. He really doesn't have any significant weighting in small caps. His only international is really Australia. Well, he's got the All World, but he could have a lot of overlap in that between the S&P 500 and then probably lesser, but some overlap in Australia. So
he's in Australia. Can I just point that out? That's where he lives.
Exactly. Okay. Well, I understand that's why he wants it, but I'm just saying that if you have the All World ETF and then you have the US and Australia, you're overlapping. you're overlapping in your asset classes there. So I think that he needs to look at maybe some broader diversification. And I think also, you know, you're a young person, you're looking at retiring in 20 years, just remember that if your life expectancy is around 85, you're going to have roughly 40 years in retirement to have to, you know, cover your income. So I think, why just plan for 20 years? I mean, let's plan for a longer period of time. And those are just some things that I would be thinking about. Anybody else have something to add?
I'm wondering if now's the time to add about the concept of Monte Carlo simulations. I don't know if it's a little bit beyond the scope, but when people try to predict what's going to happen in the market and they choose a fixed number like 10% or 12%, one of the things you have to realize is that an average annual return is not the same as what you make every year. I think a simple example would be is if someone says, let's say in the first year, you lose 90%. And then the second year, you lose another 90%. And then the third year, you go up like 300%. So you might have a really good average. But if you're withdrawing money, let's say he retires at 47, and the first couple of years do really badly, and he's withdrawing money to live on, by the time the market turns around and improves his average, even to get up to his 10% or 12% a year, he will have completely wiped himself out to have nothing. So you have to consider there are all sorts of simulations. One of them is a Monte Carlo simulation, which just tests thousands of different market possibilities, which I think is a better way to make this kind of long-term planning, and which goes back to the reason why I didn't want to give a specific number for how I think the market's going to do. I prefer to check many, 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 many possibilities and see what are your odds of success over the long term, which is what a Monte Carlo simulation can do.
Okay, great. Well, our next question comes from Dave. He says, "Hi, guys. I have to say, I love the show. Lots of great insight. There is one aspect that continues to frustrate me, and that's the question of, should someone buy individual stocks or not? It appears like the panel is relatively split, with Linda and Joe saying it's okay as long as you have a clear plan and enough money to make it worthwhile, which I would generally agree with. Miranda is an indexer, but says she is lazy and doesn't want to do the work involved with individual stocks, and I can respect that. Nothing wrong with indexing. I am thoroughly confused with Doug's take that average Joe investors like me should never buy individual stocks. I've not heard a detailed explanation as to why he thinks this, or maybe he has said it, but I've not gotten to it in my quest to listen to your previous podcasts. I'm a new listener of about 6 months. I simply do not understand Doug's very broad cookie-cutter philosophy in regard to this. Anyway, I guess this turned into a rant, and that's not my intent. Doug, I love what you do, and you've given some very sage advice that I appreciate. I guess I would just like to hear your theory and the group theory behind your philosophy. Thanks again, everyone. I really do love the show. You guys are great. Dave." So, Doug, what do you think about individual stocks? Should investors own them or not?
So, first of all, I should just, as the disclosure or the disclaimer, my almost all of my portfolio is handled by money managers. Even though I like to think I'm a professional in the field, I outsource just probably 95%. I do own a couple of stocks, and I do own them just because I feel it's kind of good education for my kids, and it gives us something to talk about. So I wouldn't say I'm a total absolutist because I do own some, but the reasons I don't think people should do it is, well, number one, most people are bad at it. They're just not good at picking stocks, except obviously Linda, who teaches people to be good at it. But the average person does a really bad job. And if you're going to do it for anything more than just a satellite part of your portfolio, like our previous letter, Matthew said he does, I think you're setting yourself up for failure. I think if someone, and by the way, I'm not just making this up, the statistics prove it, and certainly my anecdotal evidence of working with clients, and they have these great ideas, and they say, I think I'm going to invest in this, and they discover they can't handle the risk, because when the stock drops, they end up selling. They don't know how to diversify properly, because they get emotionally involved in one stock or another, and they end up buying companies that don't really match what their needs are. So I hope I'm being a little more clear. I can go on and on about why I'm not a big individual stock picker, but I think those are kind of the top three reasons.
Yeah, and just to clarify, I actually don't teach people how to buy individual stocks. Once again, I teach people how to invest using ETFs.
Sorry, but you know a lot about it.
I have mentioned on occasion, thank you. Yes, I have invested successfully in individual stocks. I do think that the reason why a lot of people aren't successful in individual stocks is because they don't really educate themselves on how to do it. Before they do it, they just buy a random stock or a company that they know or something like that. And I don't think they actually learn the system, which is why I always am recommending Investors Business Daily, because I think they do an incredible job at giving people a system and support around picking stocks if that's what they want to do. However, I think people need to get an education on how to do it if they're going to do it. And I think they need to be careful because a lot of times they don't have the diversification. People tend to maybe pick a few technology stocks, and we know, you know, back from the tech bubble, that's a dangerous thing to do. There's no real diversification. People don't really realize how much additional risk they're taking. So I just would tell him to have a system, be educated about it, and be very cautious and diversify. Anyone else want to throw something in, Miranda? Or
I got nothing. No, I just think it's great that, you know, he does acknowledge that the core of his portfolio is the indexing, and then he kind of looks for alpha on top of that. And I think as long as that's working for you and it's a style that helps you reach your goals and that you're comfortable with, sure.
Okay.
Yeah. And I would just agree with Doug and, you know, what Linda said, I mean, with Doug about the average person, the average investor not doing individual stock picking well, I completely agree. When I was at Merrill Lynch and I had clients do the same thing. They're like, I want this. I want to do this, this, and this. Everybody has an idea or a friend has a pick or something, and they think they have the smartest, best answer. And there's just not a whole lot. And like Linda, like you said, there's just not a whole lot of systematic process behind it. It's just a gut or a feeling or what your neighbor said. It rarely plays out. I've seen clients literally use, or not even use like the best system, and literally use this one system in picking their stocks, and one might do really well, one might do really poorly. And I think unless you feel really comfortable with it and have a really great, well-informed system in place, I think it doesn't make sense to do it. Just keep it simple.
Yeah, I would just add to that, that the difference between what certainly I talk about and some of us talk about here and picking stocks is what I do is much more boring. It's mine is kind of building wealth by investing and sitting and watching your wealth grow. You know, I don't have the kind of conversations with people about, hey, look at that hot new stock and look at this great new invention and how can we make so much money? So it is more fun. And I think that's what attracts a lot of people to it. And that's also how a lot of brokers who, you know, are charging commissions on every transaction, you know, are making money because they're going for the sex appeal as opposed to the long-term slow but steady growth. And that's probably a major difference.
Yeah. And the worst thing you can do is buy on a tip. Don't ever buy a stock on somebody's, you know, hot tip. It's just not a good idea. All right. So our next question comes from Dwight. He says, I recently got a raise that is netting my wife and me a few hundred additional dollars a month. We don't have any immediate or anticipated budgetary needs for these funds. We also already have a solid emergency fund. We're contributing 10% of our gross income to our 401ks. Which is more than we need to take advantage of the match, and we're saving for our kids' college. We're about 4 years into a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage with a 4% interest rate. Would it make more sense to use the additional funds to make additional principal payments on our current mortgage, refinance to a 15-year loan, which would run somewhere in the 3.6 range, but would incur $3,000 to $4,000 in closing costs, or invest the additional funds in our 401k? What do you think, Shannon?
I would say option C. Which is invest the additional funds in a brokerage account, not necessarily in a retirement account. But again, not knowing their total picture. What I see with clients is a lot of them do really well as far as emergency savings, or not everybody does really well with emergency savings, but they have emergency savings and then they have retirement savings, and they think that it's a barbell approach to their overall wealth and assets. And what I don't see enough of is clients planning for medium term goals and the time between now and retirement. And people think, you know, they don't feel comfortable investing, but you can invest those extra funds. And I'm more on the investment side than I am on the debt repayment side, because I'm one of those people who feels like you can make more than your 4% mortgage or 3.6% mortgage investing. And I feel like if you can make more investing, then it makes more sense. You're just getting more bang for your buck. So I would be more in line with the investing and again, having somewhere in the middle. So not necessarily on the retirement side, but that you're investing in a brokerage account so that if you need that money before you hit 59 and a half, you have it available in a brokerage account, but it's earning more than your bank account at, you know, 0%, 1%.
Mm-hmm. That's very sound advice. Miranda, do you have something to add to that?
Yeah, I just agree with Shannon to put the money elsewhere. The reality is that you know, a 4% interest rate isn't terrible. Depending on your situation, the interest might be tax deductible. And, you know, and I'm a huge proponent of using low interest tax deductible debt and letting that kind of just pay it off and then look for potentially higher returns elsewhere. Because, you know, paying down the debt or, you know, getting rid of it early, you know, that's a 4% guaranteed return. But, you know, what could you else could you be doing with the money? So I think it really depends, too, on how comfortable you are with your debt situation. There are people who just hate debt and they're just like, we got to get rid of it as soon as possible or I won't be able to sleep at night. That's a different story. If you won't be able to sleep at night, then by all means, pay down that debt as quickly as you can, refinance to, you know, and get rid of it. But the problem with refinancing to a 15-year loan is if you run into problems later on down the road and you're having a hard time making that higher mortgage payment because it will be a higher mortgage payment, then you don't have any wiggle room. At least if you keep it at a 30-year loan, if you run into trouble down the road, you know, you can say, oh, well, I feel like I want to pay it off early so you can make extra payments if you feel like you need to get rid of that debt. But if you run into trouble, then at least you can scale back those extra payments. Once you lock into a 15-year mortgage, you're stuck with that payment. So those are just some things to think about as you move forward.
Very well said. Doug, something to add?
I'm a little bit of a debt hater. I think it's a good rate and interest rates are relatively low, so you're getting a good mortgage deal. But I remember when I paid off my mortgage, it was like I was so excited and I felt a lot freer not to have to pay it. And then I had a lot of free cash flow. It seems that Dwight does have enough money, or he's suggesting he has enough money to manage the increased cost. I think a lot of this is psychological because no one knows what's going to happen with the market or the mortgage. But the benefit of putting money into your house is once it's to pay down the mortgage and build up equity in your house, is that's like a forced savings. Once you lock yourself into it, you're going to do it. Most people, I don't think, would prefer to default on their mortgage just to go buy a new TV. Whereas if money is a little bit more available to you, you might end up spending it before you know it.
Well, I'm more along the lines, I think, of Miranda and Shannon with the agreement that it makes sense to put the additional funds into your 401k and not to go to the 15-year mortgage. I would suggest maybe a 1/12th additional payment per month. So if your mortgage is $1,200 a month, 1/12th would be an extra $100 that you could add on to that. Pay $1,300 a month, and that way you're paying one extra payment a year, which can affect your mortgage and save you 7 or more years of paying off your mortgage. So it can help act more like a 15-year mortgage without having to have the higher payment that Miranda mentioned or the closing costs. So I would just recommend that. But good questions and good that you are being very conscious about that, Dwight. We'll take a break between our listener questions here just for a second to listen to our sponsor, the Buzz Index.
Yeah, these have been some great listener questions and we are ready to answer more of your questions. But first, our sponsor, Buzz Index, wants to know if you've ever wondered if there is a way to capitalize on all the online chatter out there on social media. And there is. The same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds are now at your fingertips. You can make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index, licensed to an exchange-traded fund and trading under ticker symbol BUZ, provides investors with a portfolio of securities that delivers a basket of large cap US equities, which now shows the highest degree of positive investor sentiment. No surveys, no guessing. Buzz only tracks what's volunteered. And if you are online, you know that a lot of information is volunteered. Millions of blog posts, comments, and blogs are analyzed each month. Here's how it works. First, Buzz targets the most mentioned large cap US stocks across the social media landscape. The more active the conversation, the greater the reliability of the buzz. Each of the most mentioned stocks is then given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics, and the 75 stocks with the most bullish scores are included in the index. Each month, the buzz is tracked to capture the latest big data-driven insights, positioning the buzz to capture the highest return potential. Invest in the wisdom of the crowds. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information.
All right, let's go on to Lynn. Lynn says, hi, really like your podcast. Thanks so much for your insight. I'm getting into investing and recently made my first investment. Yay! There is one recurring theme throughout your podcast, and that is the time frame. Knowing the time frame you're investing for when deciding how to or what to invest in. I'm mainly investing in indexing and ETFs, but I'm open for suggestions and want to learn more rather than setting anything in stone. So to my question, I have two time frames. One is a bit shorter, about 5 years, and one is longer, about 20 to 25 years. So what does that mean for me? What should I think about when investing for 5 years versus 20 years? Best regards, Lynn. So Miranda, what do you think about the time horizon?
Yeah, so one of the investing strategies that you can use is called the bucket strategy, and I'm sure you guys know about this as well. You divide your money into buckets, money that you're going to need in 5 years or less, then money that you're going to need in like 5 to 10 years, and then money that you're going to need in 10 to 20 years or 20 plus years. You can have 3 buckets, 4 buckets, whatever works for you. It's fine to have different goals. And in fact, I have different goals. I have a travel fund and I put money in this travel fund each month. And because I know I'm going to need the money in less than 5 years, I'll probably need it in less than a year because it's my travel fund. But I actually have a different asset allocation for that bucket. So depending on your goals and your timeframes, then yes, you definitely want to have different asset allocations. One of the things that I do is my travel fund bucket is about a split between stocks and bond, stock and bond ETFs, about 60-40. So I have 60 in stocks, 60% in a stock ETFs, and 40% in bond ETFs for my short term, because that is an asset allocation I'm comfortable with. For my long term asset allocation for my retirement account, which I don't expect to touch for another, 25 years or so, 20 to 25 years, I have it in 90% stocks because I have more time for that. So look at what you're comfortable with in terms of asset allocation, and for sure divide up your money goals and change your asset allocation based on when you think you'll need the money.
All right, Doug.
It's a good question because I think 5 years is a particularly hard time period to invest for, because sometimes people just say, oh, I need the money in the short term, and they don't need the money in the short term, they're just saying it. But let's say, for example, you're really planning on buying a house in 4 or 5 years, so you really do need the money at that point. These days, with interest rates so low, it's very hard to do much that would be safe to get to put the money out for 5 years. On the other hand, investing in the stock market, even in something that you feel might be really conservative stocks, which I don't even believe in that term, if you did something like that and the market crashes, if you were, let's say if we were in 1998, let's say today is the same as 1998 and you invested, and then a few years later the market crashed and you didn't have time for it to recover, you'd be really stuck. So unfortunately, I think the answer is that for the shorter bucket, and I totally agree with Miranda's description of buckets, I think that for that part of it, you're going to have to bite the bullet and just accept something that is an incredibly uninspiring return, like short-term bonds or even CDs if you could buy them. But the one thing you have to be really afraid of would be a short-term bond fund, which today is going to give you a higher yield probably than if you bought an individual bond on your own. But one of the main differences between bonds and bond funds is that a bond is something that you buy it, and let's say you bought a 5-year bond, you would know that you're going to get back your principal in 5 years if the issuer doesn't default. That's the deal on a bond. It's a loan, and you get the money back. But a bond fund has no maturity date. It's perpetual. So if something happens, like interest rates rising, which would normally make bond funds go down in value, you can't wait it out and wait for the maturity. So that would not be a good tool for someone who's got a specific goal 5 years out to buy a bond fund.
Excellent distinction between the bond and the bond fund, Doug. That's so important right now. What do you think, Shannon?
I'm with Miranda again on the buckets. Lynn accurately described what the buckets are. You have a medium-term bucket, which I would call the 5 to 10-year bucket, and then 20, 25 years. And I'm one of those people who feels like you can take more risk in the stock market. So I would be with Miranda on a 5-year goal, 60-40, 60% stocks, 40% bonds. And then for the longer, I would be 90-10, 90% stocks, 10% bonds. And, I think people get scared of investing in the stock market, when they have a less than 5 to 10 year goal, they might need the money, but that's why you don't put 100% in the stock market. And I'm one of those people who feels the stock market really has about a 2-year life cycle. So, even the worst case scenario we had in recent times was 2009, where the markets dropped in half. and it recovered in about 4 years. So a little bit longer than the 2 year life cycle, but that's one of the worst, you know, market situations we've had since the Great Depression. So even in an extreme situation, you know, there's still, you're going to have recovery in the market because there's always greed in the stock market. So whenever it drops low enough, you're going to have plenty of money. The sharks come out of the water and that is going to help your portfolio. So that's why I feel more confident or comfortable saying a 60-40% allocation would work over a 5 year time frame.
All right, excellent. You know, Lynn doesn't really tell us what the plan is for the 5 year money versus the 20 year money, if the 5 year money is to buy a house or something like that. So I would hope that there is some designated destination for that 5 year money that is a reason why they couldn't invest longer term, because otherwise I think it should be longer term money. All right, we're moving on to Jason. Hello, I was listening to Money Tree episode 116 recently, and you all kept talking about picking ETFs when you have a small amount of money per month to invest. I'm wondering why you seem to prefer ETFs over mutual funds. If a mutual fund and ETF are almost identical in holdings, why would you pay a brokerage fee each month, week, whatever, instead of just keep investing into a mutual fund, which typically would have no fees when automatically adding funds? Thanks, Jason. Doug, do you want to take that one?
Jason, I'm with you. You are correct. I think that if you are going to be paying a fee every time you go into an ETF, that's really going to eat into your returns, especially if you're doing relatively small amounts of money. Mutual funds can be a much better tool for this simply because of the difference in transaction cost. Calculate it out, but I think you're right on.
Okay, so here's my thing. So you can actually find plenty of brokerages offer transaction fee-free ETFs. So you can go into these brokerages, look for their selection of fee-free ETFs, and you don't have to pay that fee. That's actually how I do it with, I do use Betterment, as we know, but I also have another brokerage account, and I look for their fee-free ETFs, and that is what I invest in. So I don't have to pay that fee each time. And then the other nice thing about an ETF versus a mutual fund is you have a lower expense ratio. So like the expense ratio on some of the ETFs that I have is 0.04%. Compare that to even an index fund where you might have like a 0.5% or a 0.75%. So if you are worried about those fees, I agree with Doug. If you're paying those fees and you have a small amount of money, there's no point in doing an ETF. There are plenty of no-load mutual funds that you can get into and use a small amount of money, and you don't have to keep paying those brokerage fees. But if you are interested in saving on the expense ratio, you can look for the ETFs that do not charge the commissions, and then you don't have to worry about those fees, and you get a lower expense ratio to boot.
Well said, Miranda. Shannon, anything to add to that?
No, I just completely agree with Miranda. Don't pay transactional fees that you don't have to do, and there are plenty of places where you can go that won't charge that, and like she said, over time, you'll have less fees, you know, from ETFs that, you know, we have clients that, like you said, three to four cents versus a mutual fund that might be 75 cents to a dollar ongoing fees, plus the tax implications too. If it's out of a retirement account, if it's in a brokerage account, you know, you have more likelihood for having a taxable implication with a mutual fund than an ETF, which will cost you money.
Yeah. And aside from the fee situation, I think the reason why we prefer ETFs over mutual funds is simply the broader diversification for the lower cost versus an outperformance versus mutual funds, which the majority tend not to outperform ETFs. So you're paying extra fees to have a money manager, and they haven't been outperforming ETFs historically. So
yeah, but don't forget, a lot of mutual funds that you might be buying into, even open-end mutual funds that don't charge a fee, there are index funds that do the same thing. So if it's just a question of the fee, you can buy mutual funds that are index funds as well. So they're just tracking the index, and you're not relying on a manager if you don't find one you like.
Mm-hmm. All right. And we're moving on to Evan. Evan says, thanks for all you do educating investors at all levels through excellent interviews, thoughtful analysis, and entertaining conversation. Hope my question is a fun one for you. I'm a 31-year-old professional planning on taking 5 years off to sail around the world, and I want reliable investment income while I'm out sailing. I have $500,000 in equity in multifamily rentals, reliably netting $3,000 per month cash flow, plus very sizable reserves, and I have $500,000 in a taxable brokerage account yielding good dividends. The brokerage account is filled with big dividend payers from energy, financial, utility, telecommunication, and healthcare sectors, plus a wide array of bond funds. If you were in my shoes, what would your income portfolio look like? Specific stocks, ETFs, asset allocation? I have a healthy 401k and traditional IRA for retirement, so that shouldn't factor into my question. What do you think is the optimal asset allocation for this type of income portfolio? Again, thank you all so much for the quality financial education you provide. Few topics are as important, and you are improving the lives of so many good people around the world. Captain Evan. Shannon, what do you think of Captain Evan's plan?
I want to go with Captain Evan sailing around the world. Evan, I salute you. That's fantastic. Plus, for 31, your numbers look outstanding. You know, as far as the income while you're sailing the world, my question would be, how much income do you really need to sail around the world? You're getting $3,000 a month from that, the multifamily rentals, which is a lot. You know, I would first figure out exactly how much you need to sustain yourself over the 5 years. As far as the income portfolio, it sounds like you're in that $500,000 taxable account. You know, you have a good amount of income producing investments as well between the dividends and some bond funds. So from my perspective, I just feel like, what do you really need? Because maybe you're already getting it. It seems like you're getting quite a bit of monthly income from what you have. But, you know, I'm not sure exactly how much more you need than what your portfolios are producing. They make sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Miranda?
I think that Shannon and I are going to fight over who gets to go on the boat ride with Captain Evan. So, no, but seriously, I think he's doing a great job. I think he's really thought it out. And quite honestly, if you can live off of that sort of income and then also your dividends, that's super awesome. The only thing is just make sure that you're paying attention to how you draw down and how you use the money, because you don't want to deplete your capital too early.
Doug, what do you have to add?
I'm trying to figure out the big picture, because he refers to other assets that I'm just curious what he means. I have a healthy 401k and traditional IRA. So I just want to make sure, and I often feel on this show that I sound a little bit like the wet blanket, because I'm always the guy, well, you know, don't do it and force yourself to save. And I'm happy. I'm thrilled that he is that he has the money and the financial resources to do this kind of trip. In fact, I'm planning to send this episode of the Money Tree podcast to my future son-in-law, who also is a ship captain as a hobby. And so I want to sort of see what his response is, so I'll get a sense of, you know, how much money he's bringing into the whole deal. No, I'm kidding about that. I just want to see if it's, I just want him to learn about that. But, you know, if you have $500,000 in real estate and $500,000 in stocks, which is great for being 31, it's huge, and you're going to not add into it for a while and, in fact, live off it, you have to really determine what's the cost of this adventure going to really be, and how's that going to affect your long-term results. It may be fine. I don't want to put him down. My guess is he's fine based on his language. But I would be curious to get a little more information about the details.
Yeah, well, Captain Evan sounds like he's made some great investment decisions and has a very diversified portfolio, and it seems very knowledgeable. So I'm not really sure what his real question is. It seems like he's got a handle on all of it. So I'm just going to wish you a bon voyage, Evan. And with that, I think that's all we have for time for today. So, Shannon, tell us what you're up to at the Financial Gym and at the Martinis and Your Money podcast. What's a current episode that we could check out?
Yeah, well, Martinis and Your Money, we just did an episode about financial frugal friends and financial frenemies, and how you manage your friendships while also trying to live a financially responsible life. So very active, healthy conversation there, of course, while drinking. It was good stuff.
And Miranda, how about at Adulting?
Yeah, over at adulting.tv, we are having a good old time talking about things like financial stability and how you can find those 8 requirements for financial stability. So if you're looking for financial stability in your life, head on over to adulting.tv and read our article about how you can improve your financial situation.
Excellent. Doug, what's going on at Rich as a King and Goldstein on Gelt?
Yeah, Rich as a King. You know, Rich as a King is the subtitle of the book is how these strategies of chess can make you a grandmaster of investing. And when world chess champion Susan Polgar and I wrote the book, to us it seemed pretty obvious that people should want to be as strategic as a great chess player when investing. And so this week, in fact, on our blog at richasaking.com, we explain why learning to play chess can, in fact, make you a better investor. So we sort of give some of the fundamentals of that and also give people access to sign up. Susan Polgar, my co-author, wrote a chess teaching guide for teachers and parents that we're giving out there or helping people to get if they want to learn more about that. And that's what's going on at Rich as a King. But Linda, what is going on with you?
Well, at Be Wealthy and Smart, I just recorded an episode about the best healthcare ETFs of 2017. So if you want to know what is performing the best in healthcare, they've got some pretty extraordinary returns, and it's kind of interesting to check out. That's all for today. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. And if we did talk about your question, I would really love it if you would leave us a review at the Money Tree Investing Podcast and iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Let us know what you think of the show. That's really important to us. Miranda, can you take us home, please?
Yes. Remember to check us out at moneytreepodcast.com for all the past episodes. Subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher. And remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.